engines back, and they even said up a stage is that you could eventually shape this thing instead of being a cone like this. You could shape it into an aerodynamic thing where we'll be able to guide it better through the atmosphere. So they have big plans for these high-end things, and I thought that was pretty interesting. Let me just stand by and see if there's any comments or questions. This is WS2M. Any space-related topics, rockets or anything like that, things that people were thinking about before I continue on? We'll go on to the next topic. Okay, I think a week or so ago we were discussing the amount of companies and how many companies and countries are involved in presently launching rockets or maybe the near future. Yeah, how many companies would be involved? And I came up with a list. There's about 22 entities, you know, including like main NASA companies like we have today, Lockheed and Boeing and Northrop Grumman. You know, Lockheed is making the Atlas V and eventually going to switch over to the Vulcan rocket, like I was saying before, and they're teamed up with Boeing for something like that. Boeing is the main contractor for the Space Launch System. That's the one that's going to eventually launch to the moon, eventually Mars, four people at a time on the Orion spacecraft. Boeing makes vehicles for the military, too. They have the X-37B. That's the one that gets encapsulated inside of a rocket. It looks like a small space shuttle. Goes up into space, stays up there for a year or more, and it does all its work, spy satellites, you know, spying on countries, whatever it's doing. It's all top secret. And eventually it comes back and lands. Well, originally it was landing in California, and now they landed on the runway, in the shuttle runway in Florida. You know, successfully, but that's, you know, just an example of some of these things that the bigger companies are doing, the main companies for NASA, including Northrop Grumman, who's developing the Omega rocket, which is going to be another heavy lift rocket that will be flying out of Florida. They're going to take over Launch Complex 39B. Right now, Launch Complex 39A is taken over by SpaceX, and they fly the crew vehicles out of the out of that launch complex, as well as the cargo vehicles and, you know, to the ISS, and the Falcon Heavy vehicles as well. And that's the one where you launch three Falcon 9 boosters at one time, bolted together, and then they come back and land back in the same place where they took off from. Let me drop it. So you have your main countries that are involved, naturally the USA, and then there's Russia with the Soyuz and Proton rockets. You've got China with the Shenzhou space capsule. It takes their taconauts, as they call them, astronauts up to their space station. Right now is their second space station that's up there, Tiangong 1 and 2. They're no longer using that. They're getting ready to eventually put a third space station up. But they launched with Long March rockets, different versions, Long March 3, 5, you know, each one is bigger than the next. So they have the Long March program in China. India has the two main rockets that they use. Sometimes they'll even send multiple satellites up there. Not too long ago, they sent up 104 satellites in one launch, and that was on the GSLP, the geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. And then they have the smaller version, it's not that much smaller, but it's called the PSLV, the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. And they tend to launch low orbit or polar orbits, of course, hence the name. You got Russia, China, India, you got Japan, which has the for the space program for us. They have the HTV, and that right now brings up the most cargo at one time to the space station. That usually goes up around once a year. And they have a dedicated launch vehicle that runs on liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, called the H2B. They have an H2A, but that one's not used for the space station cargo vehicle. Just the H2B is. And then you've got the European Space Agency with Ariane 5 and eventually Ariane 6, probably within a year or two. Ariane 5 will be phased out over time, and Ariane 6 will take over. ESA also launched their own version of the Soyuz. They buy Soyuz from Russia. They change it to their specs, and then they launch it. They have a smaller vehicle called the Vega, which is manufactured in Italy. So worldwide, there's a lot of countries that are involved. But then there's a smaller group, the smaller launch vehicles. Well, not so small, but some of them are larger. You have SpaceX, of course. These are all private companies. They launched Falcon 9, now they have the Falcon 9 Heavy, soon to be the Starliner. In a few years, the Starliner is a massive rocket. So big that when they first tested the upper stage, it'll be a two-stage vehicle, but the upper stage is so big, they're going to be able to launch it from Earth and put this whole second stage into orbit without even using a booster. So that's going to be a massive vehicle, the Starliner, they call it. And then eventually it's going to come back into the atmosphere and land vertically and be reusable. So that's SpaceX. Of course, they make the Dragon and the Crew Dragon, which goes up to the ISS. They got SpaceX, and then you got Orbital ATK, which they changed their name because Northrop Grumman bought them up. And they launched the Antares rocket, and on top of that is the Cygnus cargo vehicle that's on top of Antares. So, then you got another one that hasn't. I mean, they've been in business like 50 years, but they haven't sent their crew vehicle up to the ISS yet, but they have a contract for six flights with NASA once it gets completed, and that's called the Dream Chaser, and they're also building equipment to be part of the Gateway system if NASA chooses it, one of the modules that they plan on sending to around the moon. So you have a fourth one called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab launches out of New Zealand, but they're licensed in the United States. They make their rocket engines in California, and they're called the Electron Rocket. And I've covered that many times. And they're up to six flights so far over the last couple of years, but eventually they plan on launching one or two per month. You've got the Bigelow Space Company. They have a beam attached to the International Space Station. That was this inflatable module. It was supposed to stay attached for 2 years. NASA liked it so much, they said, just leave it here. I think it's over like three and a half years now attached to the space station. They were going to deorbit the thing. They tested it out, and now they use it for storage. So that's Bigelow, and they eventually will probably be making more inflatable modules as time goes on. You have Virgin Galactic, which they had a spin-off company called Virgin Orbital, just a different name. Virgin Orbital now is getting ready to test Launcher 1. Virgin Orbital has got this 747, they plan on dropping a Launcher 1 from it, from the wing, the left wing, and that thing will eventually take off and put maybe 400 or 500 pounds into orbit. So these are all orbital. Blue Origin, I covered that before with New Glenn and Blue Moon. Then you got some other ones that we pretty much don't talk about. Firefly, and another one that's developing a vehicle that eventually will be put into orbit. They plan on, they've already taken over a launch complex in Vandenberg. The Delta II was retired, NASA gave it to them to launch their vehicles from. So you got a Firefly, you've got a rocket craft, or another one that's going to be launching a rocket called Intrepid, and then a test one called Launcher. Launcher is actually being developed in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and they have their own 3D rocket they printed that they'll eventually be testing. Once they get that thing developed, they'll put that together with what they call Launcher. And it's a very small employment group, but they're located in Brooklyn Navy Yard. So you've got relativity space, you've got Orbex space. Well, Orbex space comes out of England, I think. You've got UP Aerospace. They've launched some suborbital vehicles from New Mexico at Spaceport America. Vector Space, another one. They're launching out of they want to launch out of Georgia, of all places, Camden, Georgia. Eventually, they plan on having their heavy version, be able to put a couple of thousand pounds into space every time they launch. Landscape China, well, that's Landscape is China, or a company. So that's what you got. You've got at least 22 different entities and people involved with the space program. So when they say NASA has a $21 billion budget, that's true, but there's so many other people worldwide that are involved in this. And that number, collectively, is quite a big number if you add up all these companies and projects that they've done and will be doing in the not-too-distant future. So I thought that was interesting, yeah. Any comments or questions for the SpaceNet report, part of the TechNet?
Paul, I was thinking about your suggestion last week that the craft is going to land on the moon, that you want to be habitable, and your suggestion was if you put a very large parasol above it that's reflective, like they did on the early Skylab, that they can reflect an awful lot of the heat. And you might have to make it out of two or three layers, like you did on the James Webb Space Telescope. It's got, I think, five layers to its heat shield, because they're trying to get down to some really cold temperatures on the far side of those five layers. So with enough layers of parasol or umbrella-like highly reflective material, I think I agree with you. You will be able to keep the habitat from becoming overheated during the high noon on the moon. So not getting it too hot, I see a way of doing it. But now not making sure it doesn't get too cold, that's still a tough one. It's going to take a lot of energy storage of some kind to create a tremendous amount of heat for that minus 100 degrees centigrade, which is minus almost 200 degrees Fahrenheit that you get at midnight on the moon. Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
And you could have, you could design this with different flaps, they could open and close, and to some degree, and, you could add a little sunlight, take some sunlight away. I could imagine doing something like that. You're going to have the crusty, I know we talked about that a number of times, including last week. That's the kilopower reactor using Stirling engines, and they've developed these things already, and they've tested them, and they're between 2 and 10 kilowatt output, so a tremendous amount of power out of these things. And the initial plan would be to put 4 of these on the moon, and that would give them a lot of heat. You could imagine running, fission, they're essentially fission reactors, uranium-235 on the moon, with these very efficient Stirling engines, which, it's like no friction whatsoever. They've had one operating, I think, for 10 years in a test lab somewhere. 10 years, it just keeps going and going. The engine itself is not being run on fission, but they have it heated where the Stirling engine just keeps going and going, like the Energizer Bunny. So that's good. They plan on going to the south and traveling. down to the southern part of the moon first. They'd like to get near Shackleton Crater and a number of the craters. Deep down in the craters, it's frozen ice. They could mine it out. You know, I mean, it'd not be in the beginning, but you know, maybe decades from now, to be able to mine this stuff out of the ground and bring it inside, melt it. Now they have water. Water eventually gives them hydrogen and oxygen, good for breathing, good for fuel. In fact, you can have a backup system once you have the two different gases, hydrogen and oxygen. You could have fuel cells up there, and that could generate electricity in case one, you know, your power grid goes out on your fission thrusting system. So that might be a way out for the nighttime period. But again, on the south side of the moon, you don't have as much dark to contend with as you would on the equator part of the moon. So, I don't know. But now they'd be happy, I'm sure, just to have some kind of system where you could land on the moon even for, you know, a week or two and then get them back before things go bad. They plan on eventually having rovers and robotic equipment being operated by people in Gateway. So they envision these people sitting at consoles looking down at the moon from orbit, operating this equipment that's on the moon. I can imagine this thing going down to Shackleton Crater and, you know, grinding out the ice that's been there since the beginning of time, bringing it back and eventually heating it up with some process and winding up with valuable water on the moon. I could see that happening. There was a launch that was supposed to go off last week. Let me drop it. It was called the Starlink. Starlink is being developed by SpaceX. I don't know if you saw this story, but they plan on launching this. Well, this is going to be their first main rocket with 60 satellites, and each satellite is going to be used for interconnecting, you know, broadband for people on Earth. And I believe one of the frequencies they're going to use is 24 gigahertz, I believe. But get the details on that. They're going to use three different bands. But nevertheless, this first rocket that SpaceX is going to launch from far, the Launch Complex 40, I was watching it the other night, and then it was scrubbed because of high winds in the upper atmosphere. Watched the next night, came on, and they were about to, they had like 15 minutes left, and right away the announcer for SpaceX said, I know we came on, but we're going right back off because we just found out that they've decided to spend some more time, like about a week or so, on the programming of all these satellites. And these satellites, they're big. I mean, each one, they say, weighs 500 pounds. And they're putting 60 of these things in there in one, you know, in one bearing on the top of the spacecraft, which comes out to around 30,000 pounds. 30,000 pounds, the Hubble Space Telescope weighed, you know, like 2,500 pounds. Yeah, so this thing's heavier than Hubble. It's got to be the heaviest thing that SpaceX has lifted off so far, including that Arab satellite they sent up on the Falcon Heavy. That wasn't even this heavy. So they got this thing loaded with these things. They're going to get it to space around 270 miles up, not that high. So I could see that, you know, helping out, that, you know, they're not going to blast it that high. And that's not going to be their operating altitude, 250 miles. Their altitude is going to be around 350 miles up. So they have to get up another 100 miles. How are they going to do that? Each one of these Starlink satellites that SpaceX is sending up is going to have on board a all ion thruster. So, you know, the ion thrusters, they've been around since European Space Agency tested one, 15, 20 years ago. They sent smart one to the moon. That was the first one that went up. We've been sending them up on geosynchronous satellites now for years now. There's probably hundreds of these things that we've sent up to Russia and the European Space Agency. But not so much with these Hall. The Hall ones are more efficient. They keep the little protons, electrons, whatever it is, that's flying out of this thing from touching the wall. They use a magnetic field, so essentially a lot of the action that's taking place is just past, almost just past the nozzle of instead of traveling, through and touching the walls as it goes through. Eventually, that wears them out. So these Hall thrusters are going to be used, and they're going to bring these 500-pound satellites, 60 of them, weighing 30,000 pounds to a proper orbit, and then separate. They're going to separate. And they also have detection devices on board where if they're too close to one another or something, anything flying around up there, they're going to be able to back off, autonomously and move away. So I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know if anybody's seen this story about the Starlink, but eventually I guess you could pay SpaceX. Not now, because there's only 60 satellites, but eventually pay them to hook up your computer, maybe telephone, maybe even TV, I guess, on the internet through satellites instead of going through cable. Now, this is only the beginning. Just to get operational, I think they said they need,600 or 1,000 of these satellites. But their goal is to put up 12,000 satellites. Now, I didn't add a zero, but they plan on putting 12,000 of these things into orbit. And that's for SpaceX. Then you have Net One, another group. They want to put up hundreds of satellites. And Jeff Bezos from Amazon, he wants to have a similar project. But this guy's naturally ahead of the curve, like always.
W2LRY with a question.
Hi, Joe. Go ahead. Over to you.
Who is going to be watching all this stuff as it gets propagated into space?
That's NORAD's job. They keep track of not only our satellites, but whatever's up there, Russia, China. Even South Korea has launched a rocket, successfully, into orbit. So, all these countries, European Space Agency, countless rockets. Look at, like I just said, a couple of years ago, India launched a rocket on their one of the space vehicles. They had 104 satellites that deployed. I saw pictures, they had a video of it, and it just went on like forever, these things deploying. Back to you, Joe.
You know what's talking like when an air traffic control has to look out on a screen, not only looking at the altitudes of different craft, but the vectors they're all going, unless they're all in similar orbits going in similar directions.
Yeah, I should send the picture over to you, Joe, or maybe to Roy, so everybody can see of what the beginnings of this looks like. They show the Earth, right now we're all at 53 degrees in inclination. And as time goes on, one satellite after the other, what this is going to look like. It looks like a mesh around the whole Earth. I can't believe they got approval to do this. Really quite something. I don't know. I was going to say something about it, but pretty much lost the words. The cost, that's what it is. Every one of these rockets that SpaceX sends up on a Falcon 9 is roughly $62 million. That's their cost. So, give you an idea, they're going to spend $10 billion to eventually put these 12,000 satellites into orbit. And, like, you know, I think NORAD takes, looks at it, I think it's something like 10,000 satellites, junk, and anything that's 4 inches, you know, big. They're still tracking the glove that was lost in Germany. So NORAD is going to have to, like, double their efforts just for SpaceX. Back to you, John.
Yeah, I think so. They must have a global network of Earth stations that look at this stuff continuously on any view from the Earth going looking outward, because it's got to be fantastic the amount of stuff these people have to keep tracking that keeps them going up there and keeping in communication with each other so that they know that, you know, this one's going this way, this one's going that way. I mean, you don't want these things hitting each other 18,000 miles an hour. That causes a real mess, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and they're supposed to see something, you know, autonomously, you know. They see another satellite or something, anything, and they're supposed to move away from it, you know. That's the design that these things have. So, if I'm going up in a rocket, you know, am I going to be sure that these things at 350 miles up, and eventually there's going to be some higher around the 700 mile area, but right now 350. And he's got the design. Originally he was going to put them higher, you know, 500 miles or whatever. But they figured if one failed, it would stay in orbit for like 1,000 years and never come back. So down at the 350 mile range, what will happen is if one fails, they figured it would take 5 years for it to deorbit. So that's their backup system. And with the Hall thrusters, they'll be able to keep themselves, you know, located properly for, you know, maybe decades to come. But that's the deal on this. I thought it was quite amazing. So there's if you go to the, I guess the one of the websites, not NASA, but I don't know, spaceflight.com or something, you just put it in the Starlink and you could bring up their satellites. They're all stacked in the fairing that goes on top of the rocket. It's really incredible. So that's the deal on that. One other quick thing I want to talk about is the Astropy. I cover this these robots that went up to the International Space Station on Cygnus, the last cargo flight by Antares. When Antares brought up Cygnus, Antares is a rocket launched out of Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. They brought plenty of stuff up, but they brought two of three, there's one more to go, these robots, these Astrobee robots to the space station. And they successfully unpacked them. This picture of Ann McLean, she got to use this thing first. They're big boxes, you know, maybe, they look like they're about 18 inches cubed, and they have lights on board and cameras so they can see. Looks like it has eyes. It's got this one arm that sticks out. It's got a claw to grab things. It's got this rechargeable lithium battery, of course. In the previous flight, they brought up charging units, I guess three charging units, and they installed them in the Japanese Kaibo module. That's the biggest module on the space station. Anytime you see an interview with somebody on the space station, they're always in the Kaibo Japanese module, the biggest one. And in there, they mounted to the wall is three charging units. So when one of the Astrobees gets tired, you know, and starts to see the power go down, it'll fly back to the charging unit and connect itself and recharge. And when I say fly, that's what these things do. They have a fan on board, and they have these vanes that open and close, essentially valves, really, that open and close. So the air is blowing through, and by manipulating all these different valves or vanes, they're able to redirect the fan, the air, and maneuver through the station. The astronauts could operate it, or mission mission control. Everybody could be sleeping, and you could have mission control in Houston flying these things around, moving stuff from place to place. Each one has an RFID detector on it, so everything has an RFID tag on the space station. So you, let's say you left a wrench somewhere, or you left some important part in one of the modules, and you have no idea where you left it. You know, you're up there with a crew of six, and that could happen. You know, I don't know which modules, and it could be, you know, behind all these gigantic bags of water for all I know. Well, one of these robots could fly through this space station and go from module to module, and it will pick up all the different signals and will find and maybe even bring back the tool that, or whatever it is that you lost. And they gave them names. Right now, the ones up there are Bumble and Honey. And, you know, Astro Bee, so they have Bumble and Bumblebee and Honeybee. And the one that didn't go up yet is the Queen Bee. So that will go up on a future flight. So eventually they'll have three Astro Bees flying around the International Space Station. Each one has a tablet attached to it, so, you know, it could fly over and an astronaut can get a hold of it, do some kind of calculation, or, you know, maybe look something up. Naturally, it's all tied into the International Space Station's Wi-Fi system. So I thought that was pretty cool. I've been following the Astro Bee stories. That's pretty much it for me for the SpaceNet report. So if anybody has any questions, I'll be here. If not, we can always go back to Dr. Roy and see what he has on it. If he had something left over. But if not, we'll look for any questions first. This is WS2N.
Hey, I got another quick question for you, Paul.
And so do I, yeah, Paul.
Okay, very good. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, who's going to be responsible for refueling these things? You're going to be launching this vast amount of satellites that go in the air around the Earth in some sort of orbit. Don't they need some sort of propulsion system to occasionally move them here, move them there, or whatever, to, you know, keep them corrected in their place, so to speak, physical placement in over the Earth as they're rotating around it? How long does this fuel last, and when it starts running out, who's responsible for going up and refueling these things? Well, you let the satellites just burn up and come back in the atmosphere.
Yeah, good question, Joe. Well, if they break, you know, that's the plan. That's why they're at the lower atmosphere. They figured 5 years they'll burn up, and they figured out that 97% of it would burn up. I don't know how they figured that out, but that's what they said. They have tanks on board filled with krypton, not xenon. Xenon is the typical gas that is used for all these ion type of engines, the xenon gas. It's kind of expensive. You can get krypton for one-tenth the price. You could use other gases or ion engines, but naturally the best one is xenon because it's more dense, and when it goes flying out of the back, they get better propulsion out of it. But it's the cost is one-tenth of the price of xenon you can get krypton for. So they have these, and the other bad thing is you have to have larger tanks, and I think that's part of the reason that each one is so heavy. It's 500 pounds each. And with that, they could last, I think they could last for decades with the fuel that's on board. You know, once they get to orbit, you know, they'll move one place or another here and there. To give you an idea, they have ion thruster on Dawn. Dawn went after the two asteroids, Vista and Cirrus, orbited one, deorbited, went to around another one to Cirrus, orbited that one, had all the fuel, and it took like, I don't know, 10, 12 years or something. And if it wasn't for the gyros and things starting to fail, it would have kept on going. It still had fuel on board, xenon fuel. Back to you, John.
No more questions. So it sounds like these things are going to be self-sufficient. Quite a bit of public.
Paul, that picture that was in Newsday where you see 60 of them stacked into the nose cone of a rocket that was about to be launched, and maybe it already has been launched. Those 60, they're all going to be in the same circular orbit, even if they get dispersed along the edge of the orbit. And then in order to make a good constellation, you want a few of those other orbital rings, if you know what I mean. So, is there enough maneuverability of each of those 60 devices? And I know that they can't change orbital inclination. That takes a whole lot of energy. So they're all going to be stuck in that orbit. Is there going to be three other launches and three other orbital inclinations? Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Yeah, there'll probably be, I don't know, 20 or 30 launches. This is only one launch. There's 60 satellites. The whole program will be 12,000 satellites. To get operational, I think he needs, I forget the number, I think, I don't know, 1,500 or something like that. But yeah, right now they're all in the 53-degree inclination. Next time it'll be a different one, another inclination. Eventually they'll start launching from Vandenberg for more polar type of orbits. You know, you can do that from Vandenberg. You can't do that from Florida. You know, they launch south and they go over the water that way. So yeah, that's the deal. Those 60 satellites, too, so many of them, to keep the weight down, usually you have spring actuators pushing satellites out as they go. He's not going to do that with this. He's going to rotate he's going to be rotating that stage. And as it spins, you know, on axis, each satellite will be like floating out by itself, you know. I guess you use a lot of, you know, WD-40 or something. And they're all going to slide out with centrifugal force instead of being pushed out, just to keep the course down. Back to you, Dick.
So the centrifugal force at the time of launch, I think you're saying that's going to be the method of dispersing them. And I presume they've got a certain degree of maneuverability on board. And 13,000. Wow. And they got approval for that. That's a huge number of potential collisions with other objects. Everything else you launch in the future has got to go through that minefield. I'm amazed that got approved, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one weapon, another one. Well, I think they had the one weapon, you know, they launched, I think, 10 satellites already. But I think they want, like, I don't know, 600 or 1,000. You know, they're not that bad. This guy is going all out. Jeff Bezos will do the same thing with Blue Origin. Plans on putting up countless satellites. I don't know how many he wants to do. Yeah, they got approval, and 12,000 12,000 satellites, Dick. Each one 500 pounds. I think 500 pounds. They used to have a piano here, and I think it weighed around 400, 450. One of those big old things. I can't imagine that. I mean, these are massive satellites, and you got to get this whole thing 30,000 pounds, you know, up to 17,500 miles an hour with one big rocket. Yeah, it's not launched yet. It was supposed to launch last week. I sat and watched, waited for it to launch. It was at 10:30 p.m. launch time. They delayed it because of high upper winds in the atmosphere. And then the next night I watched it again, and they delayed it again. They said they wanted to reprogram or update the programming on these satellites, and they needed now a week to do that. So I'm assuming that maybe this thing will go up this week. We'll be able to see if they made it next week. Back to you, Dick.
I think you did say, Paul, each of those 60 satellites have some form of propulsion on board. They're going to be dispersed by spinning at right angles the rocket at the time that they're launched. And that propulsion is going to somehow separate them just the right amount. Wow. It sounds like and the propulsion that's on board, it's good for how much propulsion for what length of time, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the propulsion also is the xenon, that in fact could use xenon gas, could use krypton gas, but they have the ion engines, the Hall effect ion engines, which is going to, they probably got enough fuel for 10, 20, 30 years. I don't know. Those things are just incredible. That's what they're going to use. Back to you, Dick.
So 60 satellites all have an ion krypton engine on board, and every one of those is going to work. And that's a high reliability engine. No instant mortality, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, not one has ever failed. Not one. And they've done hundreds of these things so far. So they're very reliable. So I think they have faith in these ion units. But, you know, if something does fail, it'll just deorbit. And then another one will just move into its place. They're going to communicate with each other eventually with lasers, you know, looking at one another. You'll be able to transmit up, hit the satellite. It'll know what group of satellites to connect with and go back down to Earth. The latency of the connections is supposed to be better than cable. They say there's going to be more loss with cable. You're only going up to 300 miles and then back down. So that's what I've read so far. Back to you, Dick.
What's the name of the country that built those 60 satellites, Paul? Do they have a good track record?
I'm not sure which. I know SpaceX is building these satellites. They have a factory set up, you know. So I'm assuming that, you know, I don't think they don't outsource anything. So maybe they were even making the Hall thrusters. I'm not sure. I'll have to find out. There seemed to be a lot of secrets about it. I couldn't find an actual picture of the satellite itself. I saw some. They launched two about a year ago from Vandenberg as a test, and don't look the same. In fact, they have solar panels. Solar panel. One cell. They only have one sticking out on the side. They don't have two. It's one of those deals. Back to you, Dick.
I still say, wow, that's a lot of space hardware. They're going to be up, I think it's at 350 miles. Do we know what is the uplink and downlink frequency? Are they going to talk to a ground station that's a gateway for internet? Or are individual customers going to talk directly to those satellites from their their computer in their home, or their communication network in their home? So how does the actual internet connection take place up all with those satellites, KQIW?
About a year ago. They're going to have both, you know. So if you're in a populated area, you go up on you'll probably beam your signal to a... transmitter that's going to cover the area. That's probably the way they're going to do it. That'll be the way, unless you're out in the middle of nowhere, out in Africa somewhere, or in the middle of Siberia, I guess. You could aim your antenna up, and that'll do it. I heard K-A, K-U, and V. What is V? What band is B? I should have looked that one up. You probably know, Dick.
I'm not sure. I think it's around 50 gigahertz, so Paul, go ahead.
Really? Way up there. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Well, okay, that's the story on that. So you got RF coming down, and you got lasers between the satellites.
And those 60 birds have those lasers on board right now with the aiming accuracy to talk in between them? In between the satellites?
They didn't say that it did or that it didn't. Originally, they're supposed to communicate with RF, but as time goes on, they're going to be using lasers. So, I mean, I can't imagine replacing these 60 already with something new. So, I'm assuming that they all have the capability, and they probably just won't turn them on just yet.
You said earlier that projects like this tend to have a name, or at least a name they give them in the beginning before giving them another name later on. Does this whole project have a name, Paul? You may have mentioned it already, and maybe I've forgotten it. Go ahead.
Yes, it does. It's called Starlink. You know, S-T-A-R-L-I-N-K, Starlink.
amazing. And have we been hearing reports about Starlink during its development over the last couple of years, or have they been keeping it pretty quiet until now? Was it a secret?
I don't remember them giving it a name until about, a couple of months ago, when I started to follow that this launch was coming up. So I knew they had plans on having internet connections. He wants to do that. His goal is to get to Mars, so he figures if once he develops this system, he can make all kinds of money and have billions of dollars to get himself to Mars. The same reasoning for Tesla, all those cars that he wants a million. He thought he was going to have a million cars on the road. By now he doesn't, but you know that was going to supply him with more money. The same with Solar City. He's going to power all his homes, and Solar City is another company owned by Elon Musk. So everything has the goal of getting everybody to Mars in a hurry.
And you and I know, at least I, don't think a human being to Mars is going to take place. When human beings go to a orbit around the moon, I guess you call it a gateway, is that considered going back to the moon? Somehow I doubt it. I think the real going back to the moon means you got to put boots on the ground on the moon. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's the way it looks for the administration. But yeah, back to the moon. Permanent space station around the moon. Well, that's pretty cool. But yeah, people aren't going to want to see that. They're going to want to see people walking on the moon. And like Roy said, their plan is to put the first woman on the moon, too. We're running out of time. Look at this. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N for the space portion. Part of the TechNet.
Yep, the bewitching hour has come. 73, you all. And thank you, Paul. Exciting stuff. Hard to believe it all. Back to Roy in case he wants to reissue his addresses. AC2GS. K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. I never turn down an excuse to give my information on the net. Again, if you want to contact me to either suggest a topic, ask a question, refute anything that I said, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. The links are all posted on roy.ac2gs.com. Those are links to all the articles, the article that Paul mentioned, and the articles that I mentioned. And once again, if you're having a problem streaming the audio, keep in mind that during this time of problems with the stream, I put up an auxiliary stream at technet.ac2gs.com. So once again, thanks to Dick. Once again, thanks to Paul. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Have a great week, guys, and I'll come up with some news.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You only lost 2 seconds, Roy. That was very good, very good. WS2N, 73, guys.
Good night, Dick. I'll have a better and more challenging question next week for you. WH2OYY.
WB2GXM, a friendly reminder, don't take your friends and relatives for granted. Get together with them for dinners, coffees, and drinks often. You never know. WB2GXM, out.
Looking forward to it, Joe.
7-3s and good night.
Sorry to hear for the loss. Thanks for the great net. KC2, SHL, I'll be clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Thank you. tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. W2VL repeater.